In 2009, Fiona Broom, a paranormal consultant, took to the web detailing a startling discovery she'd made. Nelson Mandela was alive. To Broom, this was impossible. She recalled his death in prison in the 1980s. She remembered watching his funeral on TV. She even recalled Willie Mandela's eulogy. Yet none of it happened. Nelson Mandela was released from prison in 1990.
There's Mr. Mandela, Mr. Nelson Mandela, a free man.
He became president of South Africa in 1994.
I, Nelson Rolihlahla Mandela, do hereby swear to be faithful to the Republic of South Africa.
He died in 2013. So in 2009, he was very much alive. When Broom posted about her historical gaffe, much to her surprise, she found people with the same recollections. Not just a few, either. Thousands. Thus, the Mandela effect.
A term coined to describe an event that an individual recalls very clearly, but that does not align with historical records.
Was born. All of this sounds impossible, but it turns out this type of large-scale misremembering happens more often than we'd like to believe. So does this mean we're really bad at remembering things? Or that there's something cosmic at play? The digital age has facilitated myths traveling faster and further than ever before. Here we explore them and question what they mean to us. I'm your host, Luke Brown, and this is Internet Myths and Legends.
I used to watch a movie called Shazam. It starts Sinbad and was about a genie.
But now, it's
just...
Shut up! That was my reaction when I learned about the Mandela effect. Each time I encountered it, I found my eyes rolling progressively deeper into the back of my skull. The thought that so many people could insist that
I'm not wrong, history is,
got under my skin. It's one thing to claim that people are lying to you, it's another to claim that the universe is. The things these people are talking about are either willful ignorance or extreme stubbornness. How can anyone double down on the belief that they have a perfect memory? And of course, we all misremember details, it's part of being human. But when it's pointed out, most of us tend to shrug and quickly get over it. Yeah, we may momentarily get defensive, but when there's irrefutable proof, such as newspapers and video, what choice do we have but to let it go? Personally, that's never been an issue for me, as I've always had a great memory. Or so, I thought I did. This whole topic has unnerved me. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Let's start over, okay? So Broom puts the concept of the Mandela Effect into the world, and people started coming forward with their own examples.
I used to watch a movie called Shazam. It starred Sinbad and was about a genie, but now the movie has just disappeared, wiped from existence.
Curious George used to have a tail. I swear. But it's just gone now.
I read all of their books growing up. They were a huge part of my childhood, but it's apparently the Berenstain Bears, not the Berenstain Bears.
With each post, thousands would weigh in claiming to have the same memory. The only one I found myself guilty of was the Berenstain Bears. I'd always called them the Berenstain Bears. But nothing in the world changes by realizing it's Berenstain and not Berenstein. Like, learning this did not rob me of my childhood. The only thing that changed was when I stumbled upon the book New Neighbors. That's where a family of pandas move next door, and Papa Bear hates them on sight. Yeah, he's racist. While most of the examples of the Mandela Effect are on the small scale, there are larger examples. Some even swear they saw video footage of Tank Man being run over by tanks. One commenter posted,
I have a memory of watching this live with my mom, glued to the set, holding our breath, but certain that, like in any movie, the tanks would stop. They didn't. The tank ran right over him and we were horrified. I remember feeling panicked, then later realizing that this was the first death that I witnessed in real time.
But Tank Man, true identity unknown, was never run over by a tank. While there was a very tense standoff, two men from the street dragged him away before any physical harm could be done to him. We have video of it. Doesn't seem like something you'd just misremember, but this commenter and the others, they have to be misremembering. As more and more examples of the Mandela effect were brought forth, it became apparent to some that something was askew. Online, people put their heads together to speculate and theorize about what was going on. It didn't take long before the truthers, as the true believers of the Mandela effect are known, put forward a very simple explanation.
The fact that so many people have the same so-called false memories is proof of something happening on a cosmic scale.
Like what?
We are living in a computer simulation. These inconsistencies are glitches in the simulation.
Sorry, simulation?
Yeah! You ever seen The Matrix?
You mean the 1999 sci-fi action flick starring Keanu Reeves where he plays a man named Neo who, after ingesting a red pill, discovers his whole life has been lived in a computer simulation? Nothing is real.
Yeah! This is like that!
And that's where they lost me. It's not that I don't like The Matrix. Great film, way ahead of its time. And sure, it's a fun premise to discuss over drinks or a toke, but not worthy of serious consideration, even though truthers keep insisting that...
A lot of experts agree with me, man.
Sure they do. There's gotta be a much simpler explanation than the premise of a 90s action flick, so I wanted to get an opinion from someone who doesn't spend all their time smoking pot and eating Doritos, so I turned to psychology for an explanation.
Memory is incredibly fallible.
Meet Dr. Composite, an amalgamation of different papers and articles I read on memory condensed into one person that is more interesting than hearing me regurgitate what I learned.
As we study the brain, it becomes more and more evident that our memories are not what we think they are.
What do you mean by that?
Memory is unstable. The process of recalling a memory changes it. You see, memory is stored. Every time you recall a memory, you're not actually recalling the original. You're recalling the last time you recalled the memory. Each time you do this, the memory gets rewritten.
Wait, okay, so every time I think back on a moment in my life, I'm changing it? It's getting further and further away from the original?
Correct. There's no one on Earth that's not affected by it. If we all dig deep enough, we find things in our memories that are incredibly wrong.
Well, small things, though. The big moments, that's just laziness, right?
No, especially the big things. Those tend to be the things we think on often.
To me, that sounds impossible.
So test it out. I want you to pick an event from your past, something important, something that you remember, something that perhaps even shaped you.
So I thought of an instance that I clearly recall shaping my life. It's 1989. I am 6 years old and I am in elementary school. That day at school, there was to be an event that was much hyped by my older sister. A cakewalk.
Cakewalk, a game similar to musical chairs. Numbered squares are laid out on the floor. Participants then walk around to music. When the music stops, a number is drawn at random and called out. The person standing on that number wins a cake or pie.
My first year of school had, up until that point, been a bust. In my six-year-old mind, winning a cake or pie would surely turn things around for me. But then I didn't win, and it didn't occur to me that it was possible that I couldn't win. It was the first lesson I ever got in losing. Now, while I didn't win, my best friend Alan did. My loss, coupled with his win, left a bitter taste in my mouth. And he talked about that pie for the rest of the fucking day. After school, Alan, his pie, and myself were waiting in the parking lot for our older siblings. To pass the time while we waited, Alan and I began jumping on the painted lines in the parking lot. Just then, my sister appeared.
All right, Dork, let's go.
But I hardly heard what she said because at that moment, to better accommodate his jumping, Alan carefully set his precious pie down on the pavement.
Come on!
She was ready to go home. But I couldn't take my eyes off Alan's pie.
Oh, let's go. Come on.
She kept calling, her frustration increasing, but his pie was just sitting there, defenseless. All at once, I knew what I had to do. Alan, watch me jump on this! I ran toward the pie, jumped as high as I could, and came down squarely on it. Bits of flaky goodness and pie filling gushed up through the box onto my sneakers. In my mind, it would accomplish two things. It would take Alan's pie away from him, but it would be something that everyone, including Alan, would find hilarious. But it wasn't laughter that I was greeted with. It was an agonizingly long silence that was only interrupted by Alan screaming. He rushed over to the pie to inspect the damage, and my sister hauled me away toward home.
Mom and Dad are gonna kill you.
I still have the image in my mind of Alan, him hunched over the corpse of his pie, rocking it back and forth while screaming in anguish, much like a scene out of a war movie where a parent holds the body of their child caught in the crossfire. I don't recall if I got yelled at by my parents or if I got a talking to the next day at school by my teacher. But I do recall that Alan and I were never friends again. I mean, the pie was my introduction to shame. It's the earliest I can remember thinking, I'm a bad person. And that's something I've never quite shaken. I mean, every time something bad happens, I think back to the pie and think, this must be because of the pie. I still feel shame over that.
Reach out to Alan. Ask how he remembers the situation.
So I Googled Alan, found his phone number and email. I emailed because only psychopaths call people. Dear Alan, it's been more than 30 years. I don't even know if you'd remember me, but I wanted to reach out. And I waited and waited. Then one day I finally got a response.
Luke, surprised to hear from you. In response to your question about the pie, I must say I do recall the incident, but it was Peter who jumped on it. Not you.
What? No, I remember it so clearly.
Apparently not.
It was such a big event. It changed so much for me, like how I handled myself in the world, how I viewed the world.
You're welcome.
So what does this mean for the Mandela effect?
People confuse and conflate separate incidents all the time, while making assumptions to fill in knowledge gaps. I can't speak to your pie incident directly, but with something like Tank Man, the clip of him standing up to the tank is extremely famous, often shown in quick news clips by stations to prove that they cover serious news. But how do they end the clip?
Well, they don't. We see the tank moving toward him, but then it cuts to something else.
Exactly. The clip never shows him being dragged away. Therefore, it's entirely plausible that many people have just seen that clip and have no knowledge of what actually happened after. They've just made an assumption based on limited general knowledge of the Tiananmen Square massacre. Mix this tiny bit of footage with other bits of news, a lot of time, and you wind up with a firm yet incorrect answer.
I don't like that answer. I hate the thought that things that shaped me didn't happen. It makes me feel untethered.
Well, that's a psychological explanation, but it may not be the only one.
Really?
Yes. There's a very complex scientific notion which takes some time to get your head around.
Can you tell me more?
Yeah. Have you ever seen The Matrix?
Ugh, this again. Okay, fine. Let's take the red pill. But warning, this may set off an existential crisis for you as it did for me. Once you know this, you can't unknow it. The Matrix explores a version of the simulation hypothesis, which is a proposal that all the current existence that is known, including the Earth and the rest of the universe, could in fact be a simulation. In short, everything you do, everyone you know, everything you have ever or will ever experience is an illusion. This concept isn't new either. Philosophers have been questioning our reality for thousands of years. Perhaps most famously in The Butterfly Dream by Zhuangzi.
Once Zhang Zhu dreamed he was a butterfly. A butterfly flitting and fluttering about, happy with himself and doing as he pleased. He didn't know that he was Zhang Zhu. Suddenly, he woke up, and there he was, solid and unmistakable Zhang Zhu. But he didn't know if he was Zhang Zhu who had dreamt he was a butterfly, or a butterfly dreaming that he was Zhang Zhu.
In 2003, Nick Bostrom, a philosopher at the University of Oxford, published a paper that took a contemporary look at this hypothesis. It was called, Are You Living in a Computer Simulation?
Many works of science fiction, as well as some forecasts by serious technologists and futurologists, predict that an enormous amount of computing power will be available in the future. Let us suppose for a moment that these predictions are correct. One thing that later generations might do with their super powerful computers is run detailed simulations of their forebears or of people like their forebears. Because their computers would be so powerful, they could run a great many such simulations. Suppose that these simulated people are conscious. Then it could be the case that the vast majority of minds like ours do not belong to the original race, but rather to people simulated by the advanced descendants of an original race. It is then possible to argue that, if this were the case, we would be rational to think that we are likely among the simulated minds, rather than among the original biological ones.
As Neo would say, gradually this paper gained traction with the press, which led to scientists being asked to weigh in on this, and they did. Not just fringe thinkers, either. Everyone's favorite astrophysicist, Neil deGrasse Tyson, has on numerous occasions given the simulation theory better than 50-50 odds, then adding,
I wish I had a good argument against that hypothesis, and I do not.
Elon Musk firmly believes in the simulation hypothesis.
Obviously, this feels real, but it seems unlikely to be real.
He also stated in a 2016 interview that
the odds that we're in base reality is one in billions.
One in billions? But how? Well, as part of Bostrom's paper, he proposed a trilemma that he called the simulation argument. Bostrom's trilemma argues that one of three unlikely-seeming propositions is almost certainly true. 1.
Civilizations generally become extinct before they have the ability to create simulations of reality.
2.
In general, advanced civilizations have no interest in creating simulations of reality.
3.
We are almost certainly living within a computer simulation.
As we're not extinct, nor does it seem imminent, and as a society we do have a fascination with our history and how we developed, we're left with option 3. Let's look at how this is possible. Cosmologist Paul Davies claims,
mathematicians have proved that a universal computing machine can create an artificial world that is itself capable of simulating its own world, and so on ad infinitum.
In essence, if someone was able to build a simulation capable of creating a society, there's no reason to believe that the simulated society wouldn't in turn make their own simulation that would then make their own simulation, and so on. Simulations nesting inside simulations. Fake worlds would quickly outnumber the real one. So while it hasn't happened yet, that we know of, could we actually build something like that? If we look at the development of video games, we see leaps and bounds there. From Pong to Super Mario Brothers, each advancement seemed impossible. People were hard-pressed to imagine anything beyond 16-bit graphics. In the 90s, an impossible video game appeared. Doom! It was light years ahead of the competition by doing what no other game had done up to that point. The creators of Doom had figured out a very clever optimization technique. Only render what is being observed from the point of view of the virtual camera. Much like a video game optimized to render only the parts of a scene visible to a player, the simulation would most likely create perceptions of reality on demand rather than simulate all of reality all of the time. This type of simulator would need to always keep track of the detailed belief states in all human brains. Essentially, it would need to sense observations such as the sun, traffic, and other people before they happened, so that it could then provide simulated detail of whatever was about to be observed. That's why video games put in limits, because they need time to render things before the player can get there.
Maybe that's why we can't travel faster than the speed of light. Because if we could, we'd be able to get to another galaxy
before they could program
that galaxy.
That's a clip of Neil deGrasse Tyson and Chuck Nice on Star Talks discussing the simulation theory. Now, while these two were clearly having a laugh about it, Reddit was on fire, where truthers were busy working on their own video game to real-life simulation theories. It's here you can find the notion that if the simulated universe has similar physical limitations to our perceived real universe, then signs of shortcuts and approximations may be in our own world. Much like the way an image breaks up into pixels when you get close enough to a screen. Some people believe we may have found the pixel-sized building block of the universe, the Planck length.
The point at which our concepts of gravity and space-time no longer apply.
If our world is simulated, the Planck length would be the equivalent to one bit of information, or a pixel. As for other signs, MIT theoretical physicist James Gates, while working on his superstring theory,
a concept that, if proven right, could unify all aspects of physics,
made a discovery. Gates claims to have identified what appears to be actual computer code embedded in the equations of string theory. Specifically, he calls it an error-correcting mechanism. You know those error correction codes you find on a web browser? Kinda like that. So what does the possibility of a simulated universe have to do with the Mandela effect? Back to the Matrix. In the Matrix, deja vu, that moment when you believe you're experiencing the exact moment for a second time, is explained this way.
Deja vu is usually a glitch in the Matrix. It happens when they change something.
They being the computer programmers. In the event of a simulation breakdown, the director could simply edit the states of any brains that have become aware of an anomaly before it spoils the simulation. Alternatively, the director could skip back a few seconds and rerun the simulation in a way that avoids the problem. Whoa. Basically, many truthers are proposing that the Mandela effect is the programmer running the simulation back to change something, but not everyone's mind gets wiped. And that recent unlikely events, COVID, anything related to Donald Trump, are either signs of a malfunction in the simulation or whoever is behind the simulation is screwing with us. Of course, there are skeptics. Huma Nuwadi, an expert on computational mathematics at the California Institute of Technology, says,
because it is such an overly complicated, elaborate model in the first place, by Occam's razor,
the simplest explanation is more likely to be correct.
It really should be disfavored compared to the simple, natural explanation.
Which would be that we're really terrible at remembering things. While not as skeptical as Awadi, Columbia University astronomer David Kipping believes the odds of us living in a simulated universe are almost even, slightly favoring us living in reality. But him, as well as many others, have suggested that the day we invent that technology, it flips the odds from a little better than 50-50 to almost certainly that we are not real. As for a consensus, even though there are plenty of articles and YouTube videos where different scientists are interviewed saying that they are certain we do live in a simulation, next to an equal number of highly skeptical ones, mainstream peer-reviewed publications have not explored the Mandela effect and likely never will. The reason being that it is impossible to prove and difficult to falsify. To keep us from discovering the truth, the simulators of the world would create any pseudo-laws they please. Therefore, the simulation hypothesis cannot arrive at a falsifiable prediction. Hence, it's not worth seriously investigating. And that makes it more of a philosophical question than a scientific one. And philosophically, it poses huge moral issues. What would happen if it was suddenly revealed to the world that nothing is real? Economist Robin Hanson speculates that
your motivation to save for retirement, or to help the poor in Ethiopia, might be muted by realizing that in your simulation, you will never retire, and there is no Ethiopia.
In 2019, philosopher Preston Green made an even darker suggestion.
It may be best not to find out if we're living in a simulation, since if it were found out to be true, such knowing may end the simulation.
As in, the programmer would shut the program off. We'd cease to exist. This topic, one that I initially dismissed as being dumb, has ended up giving me an existential crisis. Either we don't remember anything the way we think we do, or we might live in a computer simulation. I keep wrestling with the question of, should any of it matter? If it's an issue with memory, well, yeah, because there's enormous value to memory. Remembering allows us to imagine a future, then act accordingly. Either of these theories, if proven true, calls into question much of our lives. How many countless interactions have we all experienced that could be voided because the other person experienced them differently? Or worse? Not at all. Your first kiss? The last moment you had with someone who's no longer here? The first time someone said to you, "I love you"?
The time you laughed the hardest?
The moment you knew you... Stepping away from the personal... Let's look at the big picture to see what the public's interest in the Mandela effect means. When Fiona Broom posted about the Mandela effect in 2009, it set off a cascade of what ifs.
What if there's something wrong with our minds?
What if there's something wrong with the universe?
But what if is what all science is built on. Pre-internet, discussions like this were, at best, confined to late-night discussions by small groups of friends. These discussions, due to how preposterous they sound, rarely went beyond that group for fear of being mocked. The anonymity of the internet, though, has allowed people to post weird questions and wild thoughts without the fear of there being any sort of personal backlash. Online, people's thoughts can find their way to others with curious minds, eventually finding their way into the hands of professionals who can engage with them and offer possible explanations. The ability of the internet to allow the layman to have an exchange of what-ifs with a scientist is a massive step forward for humanity. Despite the fact that this topic has left me feeling untethered, there's still a reality to face. Whether we recall with true accuracy events in our lives or not, whether we live in a computer or not, we are still living. What does it matter if we are real or simulated when each day we wake up and greet the beautiful world we live in? Even if our world is a simulated one, it's the world we've got. So we might as well live in it as best we can. Internet Myths and Legends is written, composed, and narrated by myself, Luke Brown. Vocal performances by Victoria Adam, Tristan Hernandez, Sarah Horseman, Stephanie Hope Lawler, Amber Mills, and Ryan M. Sarrow. Story editing was by Victoria Adam. Thanks for tuning in.